All right. So just give it another minute or two and see if Commissioner Shayad is able to join us.
And this is Sophia.
Hi, Sophia.
And Camille Price, Public Guardian.
I'm Erica Fox with Public Guardian. I mean, with Office of Public Guardianship.
All right, so it's 10:02. Let's just go ahead and get started and see if Commissioner Shayad is able to join us. So for the purposes of the minutes, go ahead and do introductions. And I do want to remind everyone that for phone clarity, please mute your phone when you're not speaking, and also that this meeting is recorded. So for introductions, let's begin with the commissioners. This is Commissioner Lesko.
This is Commissioner Zinn.
Commissioner Garcia.
And Deborah, are you there?
Yes. Commissioner Bennett Woods is here.
All right. And members of the Office of Public Guardianship and Attorney General's Office.
Camille Price, Public Guardian.
Rhonda, Public Guardian.
America Pastrana, Staff Assistant.
Erin McGavin, Public Guardian.
Jacqueline Beal, Public Guardian.
Sophia Alvarez, Director.
Good morning, this
Gary
is Debbie. This is Debbie Enke, Assistant Attorney General.
All right. Any members of the public?
Good morning. This is Sherry Caton. I think I signed in under a different category, but I'm a member of the public.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
All right. Anyone else who hasn't had an opportunity to introduce themselves?
Commissioner Lesko, this is Commissioner Zinn. My phone cut out. Would you mind reading off who is in attendance before we move forward?
Sure. We have Commissioner Bennett Woods, yourself, our new Commissioner Garcia, Kelsey. Then we have Debbie Enk from the AG's office, Sophia, and the entire Attorney General's, or the entire Office of Public Guardianship staff. And we have Sherry Caton.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else who hasn't had an opportunity to introduce themselves? Hearing none, we'll move to our first agenda item, which is the approval of the February 24th meeting minutes. Have the commissioners had an opportunity to review the minutes?
Yes.
And do you have any edits?
This is Commissioner Zinn, and I just feel like maybe I've missed something. But when Commissioner Garcia introduced herself, I was taken aback because I wasn't aware she had a new commissioner, and I don't know whether I missed something or not, but maybe you'll be addressing that in the agenda.
Yes, I will.
Hello.
Okay.
This is
Welcome, Commissioner Shayad.
And it's fine. I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss something because that surprised me. So.
All right. Yeah, I will direct that, address that in the chair report.
Thank you.
All right. So, Commissioner Shayette, I was just asking if there were any edits or changes to the February meeting minutes.
No, ma'am. Not for me.
All right. Do any of the other commissioners have any changes?
No. This is Deb.
Oh. All right, then. I'll hear a motion to approve the minutes.
This is Commissioner Bennett Woods. I'll move to approve the minutes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Do you have a second?
Oh, yeah, a second. Sorry.
I can second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
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 The meeting minutes are approved. The next item on the agenda is the chair report. And I'm happy to report that the governor has appointed a new member to the commission, Stephanie Garcia, and I'll ask you to introduce yourself in a moment. She is the executive director of the ARC in Pueblo. So with this process, I did interview two candidates, and very recently I found out that, and I'm happy to report that the governor did appoint Stephanie to the commission. This was a pretty quick process in terms of when I found about the appointment to the meeting today, so I'm very happy that she was able to attend. And Commissioners, then to answer your question, I believe that the notice of this was sent in the report from AG Inc.
Okay, perhaps I missed that. Thank you.
All right. So, Commissioner Garcia, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you very much. Just want everybody to know that I'm very excited to become involved in this organization. I actually testified at the Capitol in support of this bill when it was finally passed with some funding from the state. We were a little disappointed that it wasn't able to expand immediately to the three originally proposed counties, but I'm hopeful that with this pilot in Denver that, you know, we will be able to expand to other areas of the state where this service is needed. The ARC of Pueblo, we were established in 1957, and the agency started doing guardianships in the late 1970s when deinstitutionalization for people with developmental disabilities were happening. I've been with the agency 30 years. We continue to run a guardianship program here in Pueblo specifically for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So I'm very excited to learn more about what this organization is doing, and I hope to be able to contribute. I've served on many national, states, and local boards. I was elected to this local school board, served for 8 years, so I have quite a bit of experience with boardsmanship.
Well, that's it.
Well,
that's excellent.
Good to have you here.
Thank
yes,
you.
Welcome.
Can't wait to meet you all in person.
And us too.
Someday. But I will say that Commissioner Garcia has a wealth of knowledge and experience in guardianship and, frankly, running guardianship programs. She also is representing an area outside of the Denver metro area, and I'm very happy that we were able to get that perspective on the commission, because you know, in the end, we do hope to expand this statewide office. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. I will just move on to the director report, because most of my other activities would be encompassed in there. So, Sophia, do you want to start with your report?
Yes, thank you. I have a few updates to the director report that went out last week. There were several attachments that were also included in the director report. I will touch on some of those briefly just to give you a better sense of what's happening. with our updates because things have been moving quickly. So I last reported that we were considering running a budget amendment to add a one FTE public guardian to take on a limited caseload for clients that are coming out of the Pueblo and Fort Logan mental health institutions. That moved very quickly. That was submitted to Hugh Wilson, ended up submitting that to our JBC analyst and judicial branch, JBC approved that budget amendment, I believe it was last week. So that means that there should be a long bill signed around May 1st. In speaking with Hugh Wilson, he recommended that we have a job posting available to start posting as soon as the bill is signed. So in the meantime, I have some meetings with OBH and Associate Attorney General Enk will also be working with me on creating an MOU with OBH so that we can have funds in place for a start date of that new public guardian for July 1st. Any questions on that?
Yeah, Sophia, I think that it would be helpful for the commission. You know, when we last heard, this was an idea, and then it wasn't happening, and then it happened. So can you just kind of fill in the commission on what's happened there? Because I think this is probably going to catch quite a few people by surprise.
Yeah, so this was something that OBH and I and Rocky Mountain Human Services, their Momentum program, have been working on trying to get something in place since last summer. Originally, we were running up against a time crunch. A lot of this has to also go through the judicial branch SCAO budget manager, Hugh Wilson. There's a lot of back and forth. We met about it. We ended up missing the budget amendment deadline, which was in January. I believe it was January 18th. So at that point, we were like, well, we've missed the budget amendment deadline, but let's keep working on this to see what we can get in place because OBH is really, really, really wants to give us, you know, this money so that we can assist with some of their clients. So we kept working on it, and then our JBC analyst said, well, if you can get something to me, even though it's past the budget amendment deadline, I will do my best to try and get that through. So at that time, Hugh Wilson, myself, and Deb Hudson from OBH were working on a proposal to submit for a budget amendment. I wasn't aware that something was actually submitted to the JBC until I learned last week that the JBC approved it. My intention was to, once we had something to submit, provide it to the commission and then have it submitted. But that is not how the process ended up working. So that's why it is kind of a surprise to all of us. I don't know if that helped clear that up a little bit, or there's more questions.
Actually, it's nice to have bureaucracy work faster than you expected.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think it's a good thing. And like I said, OBH has been, really wanting us to be able to provide additional services. We're already serving, you know, some of the clients, but because they're kind of complex situations, I didn't want to take on too many of these while our public guardians had, you know, various other cases. So this person will be able to kind of focus on that clientele and discharging them from the institutions. Okay, let's see. The only other thing I wanted to update you on as well regarding sort of the budget. our JBC rep is also working on a bill to correct those technical statutory errors. And I don't know if you recall that, but in House Bill 19-1045, some of the dates were not matched to the extension date of the pilot program to 2023. So that is the bill that she's running. It's outside of the main budget request for the JBC. It's going to be like a side bill, is my understanding. But that those dates then should be updated because otherwise we would be losing our general fund at the end of this next fiscal year. And it just changes dates that reflect the wind-up date change to December 31st, 2023. And that takes me down to page 5 of the director report. The only other kind of update is that we have 41 active guardianships at this point, and that is because a client that we had just been appointed to passed away. So we now have 4 clients that have passed, non-COVID related, but otherwise the rest of the information on the intake eligibility, prioritization, and referral process remains the same. And then I wanted to, moving down, there weren't really many other updates since this went out last week regarding the research data gathering or the stakeholder meetings. Those were all pretty set. And no, I don't have any further updates to the director report. I know that one of the things on the agenda we wanted to touch base on was the Attachment 3, Policy 6.10, Internal Ethics Committee. And this was, let me try and pull mine up. This draft, some of this was already in place, and then we wanted to be a little more explicit in what that internal ethics committee would look like. So I had several meetings with another director of the public guardianship office, Charles Gobert out of Cook County, Illinois, talked with a bioethicist at CU Anschutz, Jackie Glover, and also met with Emily McDonald from CU Anschutz. They do a guardianship program in the hospital. And so in talking with all of them, and I mentioned this at prior meetings, there weren't really any written policies that they had that were available to share. But in talking with them, and Attorney General Enck also met on a few of those meetings, I believe, this was kind of what I came up with in red, and I don't know, I hope you guys have a copy that you can see colors in. Policy 6.10F and 4 and 5 are the ones in red that I updated for the new policy. Based on those conversations Attorney General Eck and I looked at some of this together as well, and this is where the draft stands today. And so I wanted to get some feedback and ideas and see how everyone feels about this policy. Any comments or questions?
Is the commissioners able to see it's attachment 3 in the director report?
Hi, Sophia. This is Commissioner Bennett Woods. I, generally speaking, yeah, I think we're definitely moving ahead. One of the things that jumped out at me was under the criteria or the situations in which regarding medical decisions, that one of the sentences is in situations where the client's desires are unknown. And that seems to be the only, that seems to be the qualifier. And my experience is that particularly with patients that have questionable capacity, they may have partial capacity or they really don't have capacity, but they're still able to make wishes known. The wishes just aren't in their best interest, or they're unrealistic. So are you comfortable that in situations where a client is not given assent to a decision that the guardian believes is in the client's best interest, that this policy covers making sure that that kind of a situation also has a kind of a larger third-party review?
In situations where the client's wishes are unknown?
No, in situations where the client's wishes are known, but they're not in the client's best interest, and the client has limited capacity. A lot of the major cases in medical ethics are cases where patients' wishes are overridden in their own best interest. So if a client is able to make wishes known and those wishes, I mean, a client without capacity or with limited capacity may not be able to consent, but generally speaking, you still want to seek assent. You want to seek that kind of an understanding and a willingness. If there is a situation in which the guardian believes that consent should be given and the client refuses to assent, it's not a matter of the client's wishes being unknown. It's a matter of the client's wishes being in contrast to the judgment of the guardian. So I would want to make sure those are situations that may also require or benefit from an ethics committee consult or consideration.
Got it.
This is Commissioner Zinn. I have great concerns about all of this. I mean, we have a code that speaks to these issues and the duties and authority of the guardian, right? And the code, you know, the guardian needs to move swiftly on placement medical decisions and is required by law to take into account the wishes and desires of the ward. And where those wishes and desires are not in their best interest, then the guardian's decision is the one that controls. And I worry about fleshing these out in the forms of an ethics guidelines that somehow sidesteps the codes or undermines the authority of the guardian, either delaying decision-making or somehow limiting their decision-making beyond what the code already does. So I think we need to take a step back and look at this a little bit closer because it's coming into conflict with the code.
And I would, this is Marco, I would agree with that. And I would even maybe emphasize it a little bit more that the power that the guardian has is vested in our statutory authority, you know, plain and simple. And when it gets down to it, it is a substituted judgment standard. It's not a best interest standard. That needs to be taken into consideration. That's mandated in the law that gives the guardian the power. But I think that this could be a real problem if we have something that contradicts or undermines the statutory authority of the guardian to be able to make a decision, particularly when decisions need to be made in a quick, you know, could be in a quick fashion. Now, there are cases regarding someone who's under a guardianship that even if they have been found to be incapacitated, they're under a guardianship, but they have sufficient capacity to state preferences, that needs to come to consideration. But that has to do with the naming of actual fiduciaries and the like. So I have the same worries the commissioner then has.
It's actually adding a layer of complexity to the situation that's not warranted, and quite honestly adds a layer of reliability that just is completely unnecessary.
So, right. So this is Deb. So what I think I'm hearing is that you're telling me that an appointed guardian has more authority than a family member or other health proxies.
Yes, that's the whole of guardianship.
Yeah, that's the whole, that's the fundamental, foundation of a guardianship, and that's why this is such a difficult area, and why there are so many different views of the transfer of judgment and decision-making authority over the care, control, and custody of someone's medical decision, placement, et cetera. It is a substituted judgment framework.
That's true of any. That's true of any healthcare proxy.
No, that's not true. A medical power of attorney and the medical proxy statute is completely different. That requires the principal to have the input, and that's why we have a guardianship as a last resort.
Correct. If you have a medical power of attorney and your agent tries to make a decision that the principal overrides and is doing so in a competent way, the physician is going to listen to the principal, not the agent. That is a very different scenario than what will happen with a guardianship, because the ward has been adjudicated to be incapacitated and has lost decision-making power, as Commissioner Shayette is saying, then there is a substituted decision-making. Now, this isn't to say that the ward's opinion doesn't matter. Of course it does, and the statute speaks to that, that they are to weigh in, and their wishes are absolutely to be considered and a part of the decision-making process. But at the end of the day, unless it is a limited guardianship, which exists, it is the guardian's decision to make, so it is completely different, and that's the reason for the due process procedures that are in place with guardianships and conservatorships. Even if everyone agrees that a guardian is necessary or a conservator is necessary, there is always a court hearing, and the reason for that is because the appointment is a stripping of civil rights and decision-making power. It's a very serious procedure.
Right, and there are also new statutes that are, independent to Colorado that we've created for post-adjudication matters as well. And I know that the office has not had to deal with that yet, but this is what we've been talking about for years, that will come up nevertheless without fail. This is a substituted judgment framework, and if we have an ethics policy, we need an ethics policy, but if we are somehow creating a policy that contradicts the statutory authority in the law and quite frankly, the responsibility for the substituted judgment, we're going to have problems.
Okay. Commissioner Garcia, you're new. I just want to give you the opportunity if there's anything you'd like to add to the conversation.
Oh, no, I'm just listening and I'm just thinking back in situations where we've had, typically our individuals, because they couldn't find a power of attorney, because they did not have the ability to give that priority to someone and let their intentions be known to that person in advance. Again, they've been deemed incapacitated by the courts, and so therefore, we step in for those decision makings. We've had issues with family members who have tried to interfere and place their judgment, which we at times have said that's not in their best interest, and have had to gone so far in some situations to get restraining orders in place to stop them from interrupting treatment plans and interfering with the person's progress and treatment. So I agree. I mean, it's a case-by-case situation, but if sometimes you have to make those, in some cases, life and death decisions, and we have to lean heavily on the attending physician you know, we always pull in our guardianship committee from the board, which I'm blessed to have an attorney and a physician on that committee. And we just have to make the best decision for the individual.
And that's true. And I think that, you know, again, I just don't know that fleshing this out and creating additional policies and, you know, in addition to the law that we already have is helpful. I mean, I think that a fiduciary needs to understand that the decision is there for that is the person, the guardian, and whether, you know, in that decision-making, they're consulting the ward, they're consulting the physicians, they are consulting the parties that will provide them with the information needed to make an ultimate decision for the ward. I mean, I don't know that that now needs to be codified. That's inherent in the job, in the decision-making process.
Which is why, for example, let's say this ward had even an old medical power of attorney or had other guidance to understand, for example, end-of-life decisions. So, you know, if they're in a terminal condition or irreversible coma or persistent vegetative state, and we know what their wishes were with regard to end-of-life decisions, a guardian is going to look, in fact, they need to do that. I mean, that's inherent as well. But ultimately, that decision is the guardian's to be made.
I'm not taking issue with that. There's a process. I'm familiar with the literature on end-of-life decision-making, and the literature pretty strongly suggests that patients with who are not able to consent, patients lacking capacity, spend far longer times in ICUs and under aggressive medical treatment, because those decisions are very difficult for proxies and guardians to make, and ethics committees are often part and parcel of that. And I guess I don't understand why you're opposed to having ethics consultation on complex medical cases.
No, okay. So
no one is opposed to a consultation.
Yeah, no one's opposed to that. That's not what we're saying at all.
Yeah, it is the guardian's job.
Yes.
It's the guardian's job to have those consultations and to do the due diligence necessary to make any decision that they're making. But I don't want to have a policy out there that gives the guardians of OPG different requirements and different mandates than the law provides for guardians in general. And any professional guardian, again, should be doing their due diligence as applicable to each decision.
So where in this policy does it override existing?
It is adding to existing law. It is adding to existing authority and requirements. Nowhere in the probate code does it indicate that for a particular type of decision, you have to do X, Y, and Z as due diligence as a basis for that decision. And I think to add that as a basis for each decision, then, you know, it could be a slippery slope, right? So we have end-of-life decisions, but there are also really more decisions that are important, like placement, like medical procedures. So are we going to provide, you know, guidance and a basis for that sort of decision-making too? I mean, to me, that's just, that is holding these guardians to a completely different standard. And if we codify that decision-making process, you know, what if we miss something, or what if the situation calls for something different and the guardian doesn't adhere to that? I mean, to me, it's not helpful to this process.
And by the way, I think that we need to also make sure we understand that this is post-adjudication issues we're talking about. There have been changes in the law very recently, like supported decision-making aspects to it. But that is all that's before the guardianship is established. But there's a nuance here that we want to make sure, you know, because obviously you've got the two lawyers pushing back on this a little bit. Of course, we need to have an ethics policy. That's important. Of course, we have to follow what the code says. But in doing so, we have to be mindful that we're not handcuffing the guardian who has unlimited authority to do certain things that the code does not require. Now, if this office and the appointment of the guardian is going to undertake that by something that's established, well, that's going to have to be pled to the court at the outset, I would think, in the petitions, in their orders, in the letters, and understand that there are extra steps that the Office of Public Guardianship will take that is not necessarily consistent with the unlimited guardianship authorities in the probate code.
If you want to
add with an ethics committee available to the guardians for consultation in the office?
When you say ethics committee, you're talking about in a case such as a hospital. You know, I'm sorry, I'm on my cell phone and I'm losing.
We've been talking about this since we started this policy, and nobody's brought this issue up, so I'm just taking
I don't think that's completely accurate. But nevertheless, I think when you say ethics committee, you're talking about the medical legal ethics committee at a hospital when there's these tough decisions to be made, and as opposed to an ethics policy the guardian has to follow because that's the policy of OPG.
But not all have an ethics committee, a bioethics committee that can be consulted.
Why would a guardian stands in the shoes of the ward, right? And that guardian can access whatever they need to on the ward's behalf to do the due diligence necessary to make a decision in accordance with their fiduciary duties. Does that answer the question?
Why should not the OPG office have a means of helping them do that?
The OPG office can do that. They are appointed as guardian. That guardian is able to access whatever information that would otherwise be accessible to the ward is accessible to the guardian, and they can tap into whatever they need to do to make the decision that they to require them to tap into certain sources of information. In my mind, is problematic because they already have the statutory authority to make the decisions. They have fiduciary duties, which require this type of due diligence. And there may be a situation where certain steps can't be met, maybe in an emergency or something along those lines, and we don't want to bind the guardians to the same steps for every case because not every case is the same. You have to default back to their fiduciary duties under the code, which covers all of these things. But to hold them to a higher standard in a set decision-making process, I think, is fraught with peril, and it also holds these particular court-appointed guardians to a different standard than any other guardian the court will appoint.
Okay, that I understand. So the issue is not with establishing a committee that is available for consultation if a guardian requests it. It's requiring it in a specific number of cases that you're concerned about.
Right. I mean, I think that a professional guardian or any guardian, right, has the duty to make well-informed decisions based on the information known or made reasonably available. So if a guardian is unsure about a particularly difficult decision like the one we're talking about and wants to go to the hospital and say, I would like to consult your ethics committee, or if the ethics committee has been on this, I'd like to know what they have to say, so factor that into my decision, they can already do that. That's up to them.
So, Sophia, did you mean to make this, or is the intention to make this a mandatory committee that guardians must consult with, or is the intention to make it a resource?
Originally, it was intended to be a resource, and then I was asked to flesh out the policy further. I may have missed understood what was requested. And I understand what everyone is saying. We have policies related to medical decision-making that lay out, you know, guardianship duties and substituted judgment and all of that. It's just not within this, the Internal Ethics Committee policy spelled out. So I'm comfortable with, you know, with whatever the commission, you know, how they want this to look and what they want it to serve, the intent of it. I just, you know, coming up with a different scenarios, that was based on my conversations with bioethicist Jackie Glover. She, you know, she was, how do I want to say, you know, she was very cognizant of these are situations where you do want to include an ethics committee, or these are situations where, you know, it's routine, you don't need to, the guardian doesn't, you know, necessarily need to look at an ethics consult. So that's kind of where the different categories, I guess, or cases came from. But I understand, and again, the intent was we're going to have an internal ethics committee because that is a standard under the National Guardianship Association. No one that I've met so far or talked to has actually been able to tell me here's what our policy looks like and that's what we do. So, so yeah, I mean, I think we can frame it however we want. Of course, the intent is, you know, we know we can always consult if someone's in the hospital, right, with the medical ethics team. But there's also situations that may come up where someone's not in the hospital. So in those cases, it's good to know that we can consult with an internal ethics committee.
And this is Stephanie Garcia again. And I think if it's a resource, which I equate this with my guardianship committee, so that, you know, I can take information back because there's time, there's some long-term decisions to be made. You know, it's nice to be able to have that resource to go to and talk about options and recommendations. As long as it doesn't prevent the guardian from making an immediate decision when that's required and then perhaps reporting back to the committee what action was taken and why.
Okay, so Marco and Allison, do you see, or Commissioner Scheidt and Commissioner Zinn, do you see, you know, any language in here that we could change to make this, you know, a resource that is consistent with National Guardianship Association standards, because we committed to following those.
That's a very good point. And I had an opportunity to look at it through those lenses. Obviously, I'm trying to do that as we're on the phone here, but that's something I'd be willing to look at given the commentary today.
Is there a written standard that we were provided? I'm sorry, I'm looking back to see. The national standards is what I'm talking about.
That was provided some time ago. I can send it out again so that you have that in front of you.
That would be great. Thank you. I just can't find it as we sit here, but I'm happy to review those and then make some red line changes to this policy to propose, if that's appropriate.
Well, I think that sounds like a great path forward, and then we can take this up at our April meeting.
Let me ask a question, and this really is a question that I don't know the answer to. Is this something that, you know, we use the word policy, and policy means we're following, obviously, it's policy we're following. But then there are best practice guidelines, right? that we aspire to, that we expect that the office is following, okay? And so I don't want, you know, I won't speak for Allison. I can speak for myself that, you know, I can't help being a lawyer and over-lawyering things at times, and I don't want to do that here as a commissioner. Obviously, we all draw on our background to make this a productive commission amongst the five of us. But I think we all want the spirit of the same kind of thing here, but it's, you know, how are we putting this together? How are we presenting it? And what exactly is it? Is this a guideline for the office, or is it a policy, which can be the difference between mandates and handcuffs as opposed to the guardian is expected to follow, you know, these best practices that's within their statutory and fiduciary duties. Does that make sense? Maybe it doesn't.
It makes sense to me, Marco.
Okay, I just so that's kind of how I'm going to maybe look at it after today's discussion. And I guess part of that is I'm not the expert on a public commission, so does it have to be an actual policy, or does the office and the director, are we allowed to craft best practices guidelines for the office as guardian?
And that's a question, this is Commissioner Lesko, that's a question that I would want to run by Debbie, but off the top of my head, I don't see any problem with that, having best practice documents and internal resources.
And if, Sophia, if you can resend those standards, and then if you could send this entire policy 6.10 in Word, so just it's an editable format, I would appreciate it.
Yes, I will do that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. So, Sophia, do you have any further director report?
I do not. Thanks.
I have just one other question. If I
Go ahead.
Now, this policy appears under guardian supervision. If it's not a matter of guardian supervision, but simply a resource, perhaps it needs to be somewhere else, if that could be given some consideration in when considering amendments to what Sophia has presented here. I mean, the Ethics Committee should be able to handle any kind of not only internal ethics questions or concerns as a resource, but it also has to be able to respond to any potential ethics complaints from clients or the public. And so I'm not sure, that was my other comment that I was going to make. I wasn't quite sure that it belonged under guardian supervision, but we can talk about that next time. But if you would just give that some thought as you're revising it.
Currently, the Internal Ethics Committee falls under guardian supervision under the NGA standards for agencies and programs providing guardianship services. So that's why, just following those, that's why it's placed there. But I see no reason that that can't be moved, I suppose.
Well, the very fact that that's where they put it is suggestive of the fact that it is intended to have some level of oversight.
We can, why don't we go ahead, and I'm happy to suggest some revisions, and then we can go from there. Again, I'm just don't want to add additional requirements to the guardians or do anything to circumvent, change the duties imposed by law. So I'm happy to make changes with proposed changes with your suggestion in mind, Deb, and then from there, hopefully that'll be a good jumping off point to make further adjustments.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for coming in to do that, Commissioner Zinn. Is there any further discussion of this?
Commissioner Lesko, I just have one comment about something we discussed earlier. I did go back and looked at the council report that was provided by Debbie Inc. I do not see in there a reference to our new commissioner. You stated that it might be in there, and I just don't see it if that could be brought.
This is Debbie. Commissioner Zinn, we really just found out, I think yesterday, that she was appointed, so there simply wasn't time to inform you before today. I apologize.
No, I understand. It seemed that Commissioner Lesko thought it was included in the report, and I just wanted to make a record that that wasn't the case. But I understand the circumstance.
Thank you.
And this is okay. Stephanie Garcia. I found out yesterday myself. I was just grateful I had the time available today to participate.
Sorry, I'm not trying to be the squeaky wheel today. I just wanted to correct the record.
All right. So is there any further discussion of the Ethics Committee or Director Report? Hearing none, the next item on our agenda is the record retention policy. Debbie?
Yes, I have been working with various individuals as I've been updating you in my monthly report, including Commissioner Bennett Woods, Judicial's HR, and our esteemed former chair, Sherry Caton, who's with us today, to make sure that I have all of the documents that are floating out there and have amended, or rather proposed, an amendment to the Commission's document retention policy to make sure that I'm covering all categories of documents that exist that we're responsible for. I have noticed, by the way, that I left the incorrect Commission Chair's name at the bottom. So among other corrections, I will make sure that says Kelsey Lesko rather than Sherry Caton as the Commission Chair. But I am bringing this to you for me to answer any questions you might have and if we can resolve those for adoption of this amendment.
All right. Is there any discussion?
I have just a couple of questions. This is Commissioner Bennett Woods. There's two items in the document description. Commissioner appointments and resignations successfully appointed and commissioner appointments for unsuccessful applicants. I'm wondering what, and you mentioned interviewing, Commissioner Lesko, you mentioned interviewing candidates, so perhaps the process is a little different out of the governor's office, but we had absolutely no involvement whatsoever in Commissioner Zinn's appointment, and no documents were generated other than possibly a letter from Judicial that went through Suana at the time. So what exactly is involved in that, particularly with unsuccessful applicants? What is that we would be retaining?
Yeah. I don't know how the process differs because I was not representing the commission at the time when Commissioner Zinn was appointed, but I do know that there has been some coordination between Commissioner Chair Lesko and the governor's office to get the current appointment. I also do have in the records that Suana left for me at least one resume, I think maybe two resumes for unsuccessful applicants when Commissioner Zinn was appointed. So I don't have any institutional knowledge of how those got to be in our records, but I know that they exist, so I wanted to make sure to cover it in case that would happen again in the future.
Yeah, and this is Commissioner Lesko. I can tell you that from my perspective, the Commissioner's Deputy Director of Boards and Commissions was the person who, you know, looked at resumes, sought out applicants and things like that. Then I was called to speak to two candidates, and I don't have any paper work whatsoever.
I think we also have to remember that there's three judicial appointments and two governor appointments, right?
Yep.
Right.
So the process is going to be different. I know I'm the lawyer governor's appointment, and that now Chair Garcia is obviously the non-lawyer appointee.
And the two resumes that you have, Debbie, were resumes that members of the commission themselves put forward.
Yep, that's correct.
When Commissioner Zinn was being appointed. So, I mean, I certainly can see a need to maintain any commissioner correspondence around resignations or abilities to serve, but I'm not sure that those two, particularly the second one as they're written, is really very applicable.
I mean, these these retention schedules were taken directly from the state archivist's manuals. So I didn't invent them. I just applied them to what I had in my possession. I mean, if it turns out that in the future we never have any more of those, we can look at amending again to take them out. But currently we do have them, so they should be a part of our policy. Does that resolve that? Oh, go ahead, Kelsey.
I'm just wondering, is the commission recommending any changes to the policy?
I guess this applies only to the commission, right?
Right. The office has its own separate schedule.
Okay, and that's why it's the chair that is the custodian.
Correct.
And we're working on a separate procedure, basically, for the logistics of how this happens.
Yeah, it's really a question of infrastructure. We're just working on how we can store all of these electronically in a way that makes transfer from chair to chair easy. It's likely that even though I'm not the official custodian, I would retain access to those as well in case of some sort of odd situation where the current chair was unable to transfer documents to the next chair.
So that would be addressed in whatever procedure protocol is established in support of the policy itself.
Right.
All right. Do you have any concerns about the chair being the custodian?
No, it's just really a matter of the question of what needs to be kept and not kept is one question, but how and where they're kept and how they're transferred and secured when the chair changes, that's all logistics separate from the policy. And and they're a little complicated. We don't have a repository. So I'm assuming that at some point we'll set up some sort of repository.
Great. I'm still working on that. That's the next step in the process, but I wanted to get this buttoned down so that I can figure out what I'm putting in the repository.
Right. So that really was my question, is the repository itself, does that need to be addressed in this, or can that be addressed in protocol?
We don't need to put that in the policy itself. This is really just meant to inform the public of what we have and how long we'll keep it.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so with that, the coming procedure, is the commission comfortable with this record retention policy?
Yeah.
Then I hear a motion to approve.
I move to approve. I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
The policy is approved. All right, so the next item on the agenda is rather similar, the organization of commission policies. Debbie?
We have adopted quite a few new policies and amended some policies in the last few months, and it's getting a little onerous to keep track of them all, so I would like to create a numbering system so that our policies can be organized in a continuous format that we can reference by number. So I'm just asking you to delegate authority to me to make non-substantive changes to our policies, simply to add reference numbering and to facilitate execution of those.
This is Commissioner Zinn. I so move to give you that authority.
Do I have a second?
Commissioner Garcia, I second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, the motion is approved.
Thank you.
And thank you for doing that, Debbie. I know we've been getting a little, some organization will be good. I'll just
I hope
put it that
so.
Way. We've got quite a few floating around at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so the next item on the agenda is the follow-up discussion of interim evaluation of the executive director. And this is a HR matter, which can take place in executive session if Ms. Garcia chooses. So Ms. Garcia,
Alvarez.
Would you like this? Ms. Alvarez. Ms. Alvarez, would you like this to take place in executive session?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Then I will hear a motion to enter into executive session.
Did you get my guidance on how to get us in?
Yes, the script, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, so this is, which I should follow.
I don't know how to get into executive session.
You'll get an email.
Yeah, I just sent dial-in instructions to everybody.
All right. So this is Commission Chair Lisko, and this is a public meeting of the Colorado Office Public Guardianship Commission. It is Wednesday, March 24th, 2021, and the time is 11:04. I need a motion from the Commission to enter into executive session to discuss the follow-up on the interim evaluation of the OPG Director pursuant to CRS 246-423B. May I have a motion?
I move that we go to executive session.
And a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. So we will be going into executive session, and the commissioner should receive an email with instructions shortly. The members of the public, you can remain on this line, and we will return when we're finished. Thank you.